the most catastrophic impacts and collisions that a solar system will ever see are the ones that herald the birth of new worlds. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. For another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The first solid objects to form around the Sun in our solar system were small grains and pebbles. These collided, occasionally stuck together, and grew to be large boulders. This process of collision and merging continued for millions of years, through an enormous range of sizes, eventually leading to planets. But around the newborn planets there was still a great deal of debris, be it pebbles, boulders, or even other planets. The impacts the solar system witnessed at that time were powerful enough to shatter entire worlds. Somehow, through it all, we were left with the planets we have today. It's no wonder, then, that we would like to look back and try to figure out how all that chaos resulted in the worlds we know now. To tell us a little bit about planet formation and giant impacts, our guest today is Dr. Sarah Stewart from Harvard University, who studies the processes and results of the biggest impacts any world has ever known. Enjoy the interview by Raymond Francis.
So, Dr. Stewart, welcome to the program. And I understand you work in the modeling of the formation of planets and planetary bodies, among other things. And I'm curious about the role that large impacts play in the formation of those planetary bodies.
Over the past 10 to 20 years, we have completely changed our thinking about the end stage of planet formation. Previously, we thought that planets grew from planetesimals until their final size, but now we realize that the end stage involves impacts between comparably sized protoplanets, and these events are extremely energetic and they happen to every body in the solar system.
Okay, and so this is as opposed to small masses accreting onto a growing sort of central body. And how does that change the way we think about the evolution of the early solar system?
When you just have a small piece of material impacting a planet, it usually will accrete to that planet and help it grow. And that is one of two outcomes. It accretes or it might vaporize and escape. But with giant planets, you can have many different kinds of outcomes because the geometry of the impact becomes more important.
Okay, so what kind of outcomes could you get?
You can have what we call a graze and merge event, where two bodies hit, separate, and hit again, and spin off multiple moons. And we think that's what happened with the Pluto system and the Haumea system in the Kuiper Belt. The original moon formation model is very much a graze and merge, and Robin Knupp's new model is a graze and merge. Or you could have something like catastrophic disruption, where you break a planet into many smaller pieces, and we see that in the asteroid belt with asteroid belt families, and it's the proposed formation model for Mercury.
For Mercury. What evidence has led to that change in thinking about the nature of the size of the impacting bodies?
Improvements in computational power.
Okay.
Previously, we literally could not run planet formation simulations with enough particles to address the end stage of planet formation and all of the embryos and planetesimals. And when computing power caught up, we could directly calculate this last stage. And that's when we actually understood the character of giant impacts at the end of planet formation.
Okay. And something about having similarly sized bodies better maps to what we see in the solar system now?
Yes, giant impacts produce a range of morphological or dynamical features of a system and can explain why, even though there's a common process to planet formation, the end properties are actually quite diverse.
In which way?
It can be in bulk composition, like the size of the iron core versus the silicate mantle. It can be in the number of moons.
Okay. So the Earth's moon is thought to have formed by which method?
There are two competing theories for the current formation of the moon.
Okay.
One is essentially an erosive impact by a small, fast, very fast, small planetary embryo onto a fully grown Earth.
How small is small?
Less than Mars mass.
Okay.
And Mars is a tenth Earth mass.
Right.
And the competing model is about equal mass bodies, so two half-Earth mass bodies colliding to form the Earth and the moon-forming disk.
Okay. And in either case, most or all of that mass is retained in the Earth-Moon system?
Yes. The debris that is caused by the impact ends up in orbit around the Earth.
Okay. And is there a reason to favor one or the other at the moment, or do we not know yet?
These models are so new that I would not go so far as to discriminate between them.
Okay.
We are using other geochemical observations to try and discriminate what happened. And there are now data from Earth's mantle that demonstrate that Earth must have suffered at least two or more giant impacts. And combined with those giant impacts that must have made magma oceans, we must have blown off the atmosphere.
Oh.
And so to be blowing off the atmosphere of the Earth is actually quite hard. It requires an extremely energetic event because Earth's mass is so large that the escape velocity is high. The data are arguing for two blow-off events, and it's much easier to blow off the atmosphere if you have a fast-spinning Earth. And so that's why I currently favor the fast-spinning Earth version of moon formations.
So early on in the Earth's history, when such a collision would have happened, then the Earth's rotation period would have been faster than it is today?
Yes, and the N-body simulations of planet formation predict fast-spinning Earth-mass planets.
Like the Nice model.
Or these are
that kind of model
yeah. Where you're modeling the growth of the inner solar system planets from smaller planetary embryos. Mm-hmm. And it's simply because all of the angular momentum of the two orbits of the smaller planets must combine into the final planet.
Right.
And so to conserve total angular momentum, the planets end up spinning quickly.
Okay, you speed them up. On what order of speed of rotation? Today, if we have 24 hours, are we talking a little faster or twice as fast or...
We're talking very fast.
Yeah.
So if you take the moon's orbit today and integrate it back in time, you have about a 5-hour day for the Earth-Moon system. But when one tried to make the moon and match the 5-hour day at the time of moon formation, there was no solution found that made the moon out of the same material as the Earth. The moon ended up being made out of the body that hit us.
Okay.
But the moon's chemistry, in particular its isotopes, are the same as the Earth.
Isotope ratios that are sort of this fingerprint for the parent body of objects.
That's right. And so these models were, the older models were in conflict with the chemistry data.
Right.
And so the new model suggests that if the Earth were spinning much faster, it's easier to loft material from the Earth into orbit to make the moon. How fast is fast? We need to be near the stability limit of the Earth, which is about 2-hour a day.
So if we spin the Earth at a rate of 2 or 3 hours per rotation, then objects are close to the limit of flying off?
Of breakup, that's right. And so you can hit it with a very small mass body give it a little kick to get it into orbit. And at the same time, you can imagine that any atmosphere around that fast-spinning body is also very vulnerable to being kicked off by the impact.
Would be weakly held to the planet.
That's right.
Okay. I suppose that has interesting implications for the atmosphere of the early Earth and how that would have been modified.
The origin of Earth's habitable atmosphere is one of the main questions in understanding planet formation. And there's recent noble gas data that indicate that the atmosphere did not originate from the solar nebula nor from outgassing of the Earth's mantle, but instead was delivered almost entirely from late accreted planetesimals.
Really?
And so the asteroids and comets that hit us near the end of planet formation must imprint the noble gas signature that we have today.
So these come from...
somewhere further out in the solar system.
So far out that it's not the source material for the inner planets.
That's right. They have a different set of noble gas isotopes compared to the planet interior and other planets.
That's interesting. So we're breathing the leftovers of comets from billions of years
ago. Comets are asteroids, yes.
Yeah, interesting. So what about the Mercury system, where you mentioned the idea of catastrophic disruption? Right. Does that mean what it sounds like?
Yes. The Mercury has twice the mass iron core than the Earth. And this has been a big puzzle in how Mercury became so iron rich. And there are three or four different proposals. And the Messenger mission was sent to explore Mercury, but also to try and discriminate between the different origin models. And so there's a high temperature origin model of a giant impact and high temperature condensation near the sun, and lower temperature origin models that involve separation of metal and rock material from further away from the sun and concentrating the iron-rich material to make Mercury. MESSENGER observed potassium on the surface of Mercury, and potassium is a moderately volatile rock-forming element. Mm. And
it's pretty light.
It is. It has a vaporization temperature of about 1,000 degrees. Okay. And so they measured the concentration of potassium and a more refractory rock-forming element, thorium. And this ratio is indicative of the bulk volatility of a planet. So the Earth and Mars and Venus have the same potassium-thorium ratio, but the Moon is depleted by a factor of 10 in potassium. And the loss of potassium from the Moon was attributed to the giant impact origin of the Moon and the high temperature origin of the Moon. And so when potassium was discovered on Mercury, it was used as an argument to rule out the giant impact hypothesis. But the giant impacts for the Moon and Mercury are very different. In the catastrophic disruption case, you start off with a proto-Mercury about twice the mass of the present-day Mercury and hit it really hard, so hard that the whole planet breaks into a cloud of dust, droplets, and gas that expand away from the original location of the planet. The center part of that cloud is gravitationally bound to itself, and it reverses motion under the force of gravity and re-accretes first the iron core and then part of the mantle, but part of the mantle escapes. And the requirement to make the 60% iron core that we see today is to blow off about half the mantle.
Half the mantle.
So it's a large amount of mass, and it has to stay away. It has to not re-accrete. But that process would entirely melt Mercury and bring it up to the boiling point.
Right.
And so that was interpreted as losing all of its volatiles, including potassium. And what we're arguing at this meeting is that you wouldn't actually lose all your potassium because you aren't separating high temperature and low temperature elements. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's a bulk ejection of mantle material. And so the composition that remains gravitationally bound is the same as the original composition.
So you're not sorting. It's so violent, it just throws it away, all of it.
That's right. And you're left with a hot, boiling planet, but silicates like to condense mm-hmm. very easily and have a low vapor pressure. And so the atmosphere is very thin after a giant impact. And you could lose a little bit off the top, but not very much before it condenses completely, and okay. You retain the volatiles that we see.
Okay, so half the mantle lost, so it's just lost out into the solar system someplace. And
the trick is how to keep it from coming back, and yeah. There are various ways that you could do this. You could have a second planetary embryo involved nearby, and that could be Venus, that could be some embryo that we don't see today, that would scatter off Mercury or the ejecta, or accrete the ejecta instead of having it go on to Mercury. An alternative hypothesis is that the ejecta is so small that it quickly spirals into the sun through a process called Poynting-Robertson drag.
Oh, okay. How does that work?
That works by a geometric difference between absorbing photons from the sun and re-radiating in all directions.
Oh, it's similar to the Yarkovsky effect?
It involves photons coming in and out in a similar way to the Yarkovsky effect, yes. Okay. And it causes small particles to spiral into the sun.
Okay. And so we're still working on how that process...
The separation of the ejecta from Mercury is not a solved problem because the context for planet formation in the inner solar system is not a solved problem.
Right.
We have multiple working hypotheses for how the planets formed, and it's very much tied to what the gas giant planets were doing.
Hmm.
And so until we have a better sense of the motions of Jupiter and Saturn during terrestrial planet formation, we won't have a definitive answer for how Mercury formed.
You mean the way the large planets may have been migrating in and out?
Yes.
So their motions and their gravitational effect may have, through resonance or something, disrupted the inner planets? Or
they're in standard planet formation models, Jupiter doesn't move.
Mm-hmm.
And you can accrete the planets that we see from material that originated near where they are today. But in competing models, Jupiter moves in and then back out in a model nicknamed the Grand Tack from this change in direction.
Right.
And there, the source materials for the planets is a much narrower zone because there's an edge that's been scattered away by the motion of Jupiter, and the embryos are more closely spaced and could interact with each other and possibly have a Mercury-forming event.
Interesting. So I guess we still have a whole lot of possible scenarios, and we've yet to collapse it down to which ones are more certain.
Planet formation has so many different pathways that we are still exploring many different options.
Yes. Okay. So you also do some experimental work with shock effects.
Yes. I have a shockwave lab at Harvard that launches materials up to kilometers per second in order to study the high pressure and temperature response of rocks and minerals.
Okay.
And lately, we've been spending time at higher energy launch platforms run by the national labs where we can actually vaporize minerals that we have in the Earth in order to understand what happens during giant impacts, which minerals will vaporize and help us understand what happens to the more volatile components during planet formation.
When you throw them off planets in huge impacts.
There's a lot of interesting thermodynamics and chemistry that occurs.
I expect so, yeah. I can't even begin to imagine the interactions inside that cloud of violently disrupted material.
One of the interesting things about forming planets through giant impacts is that when you change the phase of the material, change it from a solid to a liquid to a gas, that changes the dynamics. And the feedbacks of those phase changes haven't been explored yet because we haven't been able to calculate them. So now we're getting the lab data that you need to be able to predict how much melting and how much vaporization occurs during planet formation.
That's fabulous. It's like the extreme exotic case of some of the experiments that you do in your undergrad or even in high school with heat transfer and gases and things. So what's next? What's next for planet formation? What do we need to study? What's our next problem? Too many to list?
The list is long.
Yeah.
We need to understand how volatiles got into the moon. This is a big puzzle. There is evidence for water heterogeneously distributed in the moon. And we need to understand how to incorporate water or hydrogen, and how to evolve the magma ocean. We're also working on the differences in planetary atmospheres and how that's affected by late impacts.
Right. Venus, very different from its similarly sized.
That's right. Cousin. Venus and Earth and Mars are all very different, and yet all formed in similar ways.
And in the case of the moon, you're talking about that moisture. Is this just limited to ice in dark craters, or is there more to it than that?
There's certainly ice or hydrogen cold trapped on the lunar surface in very thin layers, sort of nano layers on the surface, mixed in with the regolith. And when it's protected by a soil covering, it's stable for billions of years. But there's evidence of water in the source of volcanic glasses and now recent evidence of a little bit of water in the original crustal rocks. And that means there had to be water in the magma ocean on the moon. And that's a big puzzle to work out.
Yeah, how it could stay there?
How it could stay there. How did it not outgas?
Right.
Or how did you get it in?
So obviously a whole lot of questions yet, and complex questions. But thanks for your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So in talking to Dr. Stewart, I really was struck by just how much space of variation there is in the models for planet formation, and how it's only because we have better tools that we're starting to understand how much variety there is there.
Yes, I like that you start off with being struck.
Yeah, of course, that's right, which is how these things began too. Yeah.
Yeah, in particular, there is that element of chaos, right? So even if we understand a portion of the variables that go into it, everything, where the planets form and what they form from exactly, there's still that element of chaos that you could have a giant impact at any time, striking something and completely changing the makeup of the planet. And there's just no way to nail down exactly how things formed because of that. There's always some randomness.
Yeah, and what that means is that there are going to be dynamical interactions between disparate parts of the
the protostellar solar system disk, right? You know, you're going to have some proto-Jupiter somewhere outbound in the star system forming that has enough gravity to send something flying in to impact one of those inner planets, and it completely transforming the chemical makeup of that thing through just, like, action at a distance gravity somewhere else.
And because Jupiter formed very quickly, because it's the closest thing to the sun beyond the ice line, then mm-hmm. it did influence everything that happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, we still don't really understand how it migrated. And she mentioned the Grand Tack model, and I think you mentioned the Nice model.
Yeah.
And these are all talking about how did Jupiter move and why did it move. And we know that in some exoplanet systems, we see hot Jupiters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where that Jupiter in that other system moved all the way next door to the sun. And in ours, obviously we don't have that, but we know it had to have moved somewhat, our Jupiter. And in doing so, it was bound to influence the entire solar system in who knows how many ways.
Yeah, just imagine what in some of those exoplanet systems, if indeed the hot Jupiter case forms from an inward migrating large planet, just imagine the barrage of heavy bombardment and then ultimate dissociation or whatnot.
Yeah,
whatever smaller planets were in there had to have experienced.
There is a large question there about, can there be any other planets in that system if that Jupiter ended up moving from, let's say, 5 AU or so,
mm-hmm.
all the way into becoming a hot Jupiter, which is closer to its star than Mercury is to the sun. So there's a big question of, could anything else survive in that system? Could you ever have a habitable Earth-like planet in a system with a hot Jupiter? Or would all the little terrestrials have been destroyed or scattered or been rendered inhabitable or uninhabitable some way?
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't know that yet.
Yeah, where are the little orphan planets drifting out of their star systems? are gobbled up by hot Jupiter for breakfast on the way in towards the sun?
Yeah, they might have survived, in which case you'd have a very bizarre sort of system, but on the other hand, maybe not, and all those hot Jupiter systems represent places where we would never find life.
It could be, yeah, it could be. It's a lot of energy to eject from the star system, I guess, but it's not that hard to mess their orbits up enough that they start colliding with one another or the sun or something.
Yeah. Or create a lot of impacts. And in particular, the case of Mercury, I don't know if you could really get a habitable planet out of something like Mercury because it has so little mantle, right? It just has that iron ball, basically. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. If you get rid of all the rock, if you've just got a big iron ball,
mm-hmm.
can that thing have a magnetic field? Can it have a regulated atmosphere, plate tectonics?
There's probably some room for diversity in, you know, terrestrial planet dynamics. Dr. Stewart suggests that the atmosphere of the Earth is entirely late accreted.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Why can't you late accrete an atmosphere onto Mercury?
But can you retain it without a magnet?
Can you retain it? Is it too small? Is it sitting in the blast of the solar wind and unable to hold onto it?
But I really do like the idea that the atmosphere arrived so late and was, in fact, blown off several times.
Isn't that frightening?
It's incredible. If I had a time machine, one place I would definitely love to go from a distance would be to watch.
From a distance.
From a big distance.
Yeah.
To watch those events as they happened in the early system, because they would have been some of the most dramatic things to have ever happened in Earth's history. And they would have happened really quick, long enough that you really could sit there and watch the event happen. I mean, it would have been incredible to see.
Yeah, these impacts, I mean, they would have been unfolding on the scale of hours from the time that, you know, they were close enough to see them both at once to the time that you're close enough to see all 50 billion particles that come out of it.
Yeah, and even if Earth was largely shattered by that event, I think what I've seen is that it reforms on a time of hours to days. So it really would be rapid.
Yeah. There's a lot of question about, you know, how much of Earth material is sort of blown off into Earth orbit, how much brazing, how exactly that impact rolls out. I guess for Mercury, it was a real mess.
Yeah, well, Mercury was sitting right next to the sun, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot easier to blow away. Poor Mercury.
What a difficult difficult early life Mercury had. And now all by itself sitting.
Whereas we got a moon out of the deal.
We did.
And if you've ever heard of the rare Earth hypothesis, right? The, mm-hmm. the moon contributes to the idea that maybe that's one lucky element that happened to Earth that made it a perfect world for humans mm-hmm. to arrive on.
Because it nicely, among other things, stabilizes the obliquity.
Yeah. Yeah, it gives us nice regular seasons and mm-hmm. And climate.
Poor Mars gets all kinds of wild swings in its axial tilt.
Yeah,
Phobos can't pull its weight on
it. Yeah, Phobos and Deimos, they're They're tiny little crappy things. They don't do anything to help Mars.
Not much, no.
And also that because those bombardment gave us water. There's one theory that the water on Earth was right from the constant bombardment of comets and asteroids, which could also see the origin of life on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the light heavy bombardment, it's once it was done, right? Yeah. So at that point, presumably we were getting not only our atmosphere, but all the water blown off, as you said, a couple times, amazingly enough.
Yeah.
That we probably built up some oceans and atmosphere and then lost it and then had to start from scratch again by collecting comets.
Yeah, but it hints at a really active and very interesting and non-static early history of the Earth, which is not recorded in the rock record today, right? Sedimentary rocks and things go back 3-ish billion years, but they're not gonna tell us about the magma ocean that we may have had once or twice, and about the global atmospheric loss events that may have happened. Imagine taking that time machine you had and fast-forwarding it through, a very short time of the early Earth formation in totally different worlds. Covered in molten magma, covered in an atmosphere, losing it all again. And now we have this nice kind of steady state thing that seems to...
For now, right?
For now,
the next giant impact, which that's thankfully is not regular.
The rate of them seems to have slowed down.
Yeah. So it ended after that late heavy bombardment phase. And as you mentioned, that entire history is all completely lost to us. But it looks like life started really quickly once the heavy bombardment phase ended.
Okay, so just waiting.
Yeah. So it's curious to think maybe life actually arose even between those times of giant impact.
Yeah,
right?
There's
that
an
we
idea.
We had maybe oceans and atmosphere. Maybe life arose and then was completely vaporized by some enormous impact.
Yeah, if life is a quick self-starter.
Yeah, if it only takes a couple tens of millions of years, which that's the best, most optimistic estimate, then maybe it actually did have time to start a couple times.
And then it got reset a couple times.
Yeah, and completely reset.
Yeah.
It would have been a very disastrously interesting time in the solar system and for Earth in particular.
Yeah, if we had another one of these, it would be fun to run some experiments.
Yeah.
But as it is, I guess Dr. Stewart's coming about as close as we can get.
Well, there is the idea that we can see forming disks around other stars. So we can see some extrasolar systems, and I think we've even done direct imaging of what was potentially a forming exoplanet. So the idea is we could actually watch some of those systems, and you could catch a flash of heat or light, and you would be able to tell that some giant impact just happened, and then you would be able to see the incredibly hot remaining planet or something. So you could actually spot these impacts, these giant impacts.
Yeah, for near enough disks, I guess.
Yeah, which, when I first heard of that, that was an incredible thought to actually, in a way, have a time machine and go back and look at what it would have looked like in a system where a planet is getting nailed by almost equal-sized objects.
Yeah.
Every now and then. So that would be incredible to see around another star. Some world just got nailed.
Yeah. Well, and if we do get to the day when we are able to start observing this, even in a coarse way, in other star systems, boy, is that going to help inform this very difficult task of conjecturing how this one formed.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Zangi Hu, and Dave Kirsch. Our editors were Zangi Hu, Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.